John Watkins, and I teach speech communication courses at Ferris State College in Big Rapids, Michigan. Last week, when I was talking about my own background and so forth, and talking about the content in human relations that we were dealing with, I told of some personal kinds of things in my own background. One of them was the fact that I married about a little over 12 years ago, actually it'd be 13 years this August, and at the time that I married, my wife and I were standing at the altar, and the pastor said, why don't we all come up here and get married together? And what he meant by that was that I was not only marrying my wife, but I was marrying her five children as well. And so after that marriage took place, my sister-in-law, my brother's wife, took mercy on me, a man who had never been a father before, and sent to me a book that I have since found to be one of the finest books on communication that I've come across. And the book he sent was one by Tom Gordon called Parent Effectiveness Training. How many of you are acquainted with that? Okay, a number of you are. And so what I'm going to be doing today, for the most part, today, Thursday and Friday, is sort of going through Tom Gordon's approach to listening. And I kind of think of it as John Watkins on Tom Gordon, because I think any two people in the human relations field are not going to agree on all things, and Tom and I don't agree on all things, but we agree enough that I want to share what he has with you. Last week, one of the things that we were talking about had to do with our ability to respond to life as it is presented to us. And let's see, I guess I should turn that on. That would make a difference. Let me get back here. Just flip that switch up. And last week, we talked about the fact that we can't determine what happens to us, but one of the things that we can do is choose our response to our experiences. And we can choose our attitudes and choose our behaviors. And so today what I really want to be focusing in on is the way that we respond to our experiences or how we experience other people. And so first thing I'd like to have you do is take that sheet of paper that you have there, and I'm going to give you five situations that you might come across here at Holden. And the first situation, or what I'm going to ask you to do, is write down in your own words your exact response to these people. In other words, I'll give you a statement that they make to you, and I'd like to have you write down your exact response as you would say it to them. And the first person, who needs paper at this point? Paper, all right, is there extra paper? We have
a couple sheets here.
All right, we do have several over here that need some paper. Anybody else need paper now? Okay. I have one pen. Does anybody have an extra pen or a pencil for some who may need it? Okay. All right. Who needs a pen at this point? Okay, we got one over here. And let's see. We've got another pen here. Okay, the first situation is one where I don't know where you're sitting here. I mean, at Holden, whether it's over outside the dining room or someplace else. But there's a 35-year-old man who makes a statement to you. And the statement that he makes is this. You know, whenever I come to Holden, I get such a confused feeling It's like, this is where I belong. Away from the rat race and the freeway. It makes me dread going back, do you know what I mean? Like I should mail in my resignation and just stay on here. Write down your exact words in response to that gentleman. Exactly what you would say. What would you say to that person? Would you like me to repeat it?
Yes.
Okay, I'll repeat this one. I won't repeat the later on, but here it is again. What are your exact words in reply? Remember, in that situation, you wouldn't have time to think about it. You would just automatically respond. And that's what I'm asking you to do here. You know, whenever I can't come to Holden, I get such a confused feeling. It's like, this is where I belong, away from the rat race and the freeway. It makes me dread going back. Do you know what I mean? Like I should mail in my resignation and just stay on here. Okay, here's a second situation. This is a 43-year-old woman. And she says this to you. Well, it's like this. The kids are gone now. One's married and in Baltimore, and the other's overseas. And my husband travels a lot, more than he's at home. Feel so alone, and I just don't have that much to live for. In fact, not that much at all. Write down your exact words in response to that woman.
How old
was
she?
43. How many need more time?
Excuse me.
Okay, let me give you the third situation then. This is a man in his early 60s, and he says to you, and there I was, 2 years away from retirement. I'd worked for them for over 28 years, and they let me go. They said it was because of automation, but I know different. They just didn't want to pay my retirement. I need more time. Okay, here's the fourth situation. There will be five altogether. This is a woman in her early 20s, and she says, it was just terrible. We were only gone for an hour, and so we had her leash tied to the porch swing. She must have seen another dog or something and lunged over the porch railing. She was just hanging there, dead.
How many need more time?
Okay. Last situation. This is a man in his mid-20s. And he says to you, every year I forget her birthday. And then this year I mailed her Christmas gift too late to arrive by Christmas. How do you convince your mother you really do love her when you treat her like that? People are identifying with that last one. Okay, what do these five situations have in common? Frank?
I think I heard in each case somebody who needed to talk and get out what was inside of them.
Okay. Now, in each case, we're dealing with somebody who had strong feeling. And I use the word strong feeling rather than a problem. They all had a problem. They all had strong feeling because strong feeling can also be a very positive kind of thing. I can be very excited about it. And so strong feeling is a more appropriate word, I think. Now, what did you want to do? Those of you who wrote down your response there, what did you want to do with your response? Pardon?
Tear it up.
Okay, you wanted to tear it up? Okay.
Most of us want to make things right for people, make better. Things all better. That's our initial reaction rather than wanting to listen and do reflective listening.
Okay, yeah. We want to make people or help people to stop hurting. We don't want them to hurt anymore. Now, Gordon talks about some typical ways that we respond to other people. And these typical ways we intend to help the other person. But unfortunately, we wind up in many instances not helping them, but in fact hurting them still further just by what we say. And I think probably one of the neatest things that I have come across was a story that was told on the Johnny Carson show one evening. It was a story by Jimmy Stewart. And the story he told was of a man who walked up to a street corner. And when he walked up there was already another man there. And beside that other man was a dog. And so the man who walked up to the street corner turned to the other man there and said, "Your dog bite?" "Nope, my dog don't bite." "Huh. Sure your dog don't bite?" "Nope, my dog don't bite." "I thought you said your dog didn't bite." "That ain't my dog." It's a terrible story. But it makes exactly the point that I want to make. And that has to do with the way our language works. Because what do we have in a traditional model of communication? But we have a man standing there who is in fear of that dog. And so the only choice he has is to put that into words and put it into the words of, "Does your dog bite?" And my question for you now is, did that second man answer him correctly?
No.
Some of you are saying yes, some of you are saying no.
Lack of communication.
Maybe his old home dog is
Okay, we are getting, we're getting some differences of opinion here, and let me suggest to you that yes, the man got the message if we were paying attention to the words. You see what I'm getting at? Does a dog bite? Well, that ain't my dog certainly responds to, well, actually, I made the mistake here where I should have had in here, does your dog bite? The man was perfectly accurate when he said, no, my dog does not bite, and simply did not address this one. Now, what happens then is, let me take this situation for you. If you saw that, if I handed you a note that said that, would you know what I meant by that statement?
No.
Some are saying no. Now, if I handed you a slip, wouldn't you have a pretty good idea?
Sure.
All right, now, what I want to do is go around, and I will talk with just a few of you, and I'd like to have you respond as appears appropriate for you to respond, okay? My wife left me last night.
Sorry to hear that.
My wife left me last night.
Yes, you've been more upset.
My wife left me last night. My wife left me last night. Now, were the words the same?
Sure they were.
Where was the meaning?
It
was in the way that it was said. Is that not correct? And what we have here, now let me go back. One of the things, and I notice this particularly in my college classes, where I will get from those students, if I use this, I will get all sorts of questions. There are going to be questions of, where'd she go? Why did she leave? What did you do? All of these factual content questions that have nothing to do with the fact that here I am in my gut hurting and never responding. Now, apparently we have some people who have counseling background or something in here, because I was getting some really neat responses. But let's go on. Because you see, what happens is that we do listen in stereo. We listen on the one hand to the words, to the facts. And that's what we're listening to in terms of, does your dog bite? You know, initially the man responded to the factual content, no, he does not, rather than to the feeling content and the relationship. And what you need to be aware of here then is that every statement that we make has three strands to it. It's like a cable. And the three strands are those that deal with factual kinds of things, the cognitive, the understanding kinds of things. Then what is listed here is affective, is really talking about the feelings. And then we have behavioral components. Now, do you have you had situations when you've been with somebody, you've asked them a question, they've answered your question, you know, do you want to go to the movie? And they say, yeah. Now, you got a factual yes, and you got a behavioral no, didn't you? And we very frequently have mixed messages that we give one another. And we're saying, gee, what on earth do I believe? Now, one of the things I would suggest to you here is, if you get into that kind of a situation where you don't know what to believe, generally you're better off if you believe the behavior than you do the words, just as sort of a side note. But what I want to get to as the point here is, this area of the affect or the feeling is something that most of us have not really become very schooled in listening to and responding to. So I want to talk with you today about some of the hidden messages that are in the various ways that we have of responding to other people. And I'd like to have you take that sheet of paper where you've responded, because Gordon suggests that there are 12 different, what he calls the typical 12 ways of responding, and each of these ways of responding carries with it a hidden message. It's a message that we really don't intend to give, but it just sort of goes along with the way we say things to people. And the first category he talks about is one of solution messages. We try to solve somebody else's problem for them, is basically what that amounts to. We say, here is the way it should be done. Here's the way to do it. Let me solve your problem for you. Now, I'm sure you didn't intend to do this, but anytime you use some sort of message when somebody's hurting, and you give them the solution to it, you are saying to them, I am smarter than you are. You didn't intend to say that, but that's what we wind up saying. It is, let me go back to it, it is the hidden message of any solution message that you give. Now, the first solution message I'd like you to look for in what you've responded to there is that of giving an order or giving a command or giving a direction, directing them to do something. Do any of you have any orders that you gave? Did you tell anybody to shape up? Or look at the bright side? All right, well, what did you have?
Nothing with that for number one, but for number two I did.
Okay, what do you have?
I just said you have a talent that somebody else could use. We all are needed. You volunteer your time.
Volunteer your time. Okay. Sure, that gets into an order. Anybody else? What do you have? Anyone? Maybe I should ask that question. Who gives orders?
Parents.
All right, the authority. Parents do. They're in a role of authority. Who else gives orders?
Teachers.
Teachers. Okay. Others?
Superiors.
All right. I think that really does it, the superior. Because the one who always gives orders is the boss. And what we wind up doing, the hidden message of this first one, of giving orders, giving commands, giving directions, is that we are letting that other person know that we are the boss. And here they were hurting already, and we let them know that they are our inferior. And, you know, I never, our president of our college, Dr. Ava Glavin, I've never gone up to him and said, Bob, I want you down in my office at 3 o'clock tomorrow. I just never have given him that kind of an order. But if he had said the same thing to me, I'd go. Okay, because he's the boss. And I know where we stand. All right, a second kind of solution message that we give is one of giving warnings and threats. And another one that fits in there a lot is promises. Is there any place that you have warned somebody or threaten them, or promise them something, and what you wrote is your response. Anyone?
I think I probably did in the man mid-20s.
Okay.
I put, at least you made some communication, that's important. That may have been a promise, I don't know.
Okay, yeah, it really does, you know, it is important, you know, you've got something that you can look forward to out of it, all right? Any other places?
I did think of this, but you could, you know, with a response that you is often heard as well, things will get better, things will work out.
Okay, sure. And we tell people how nice things are going to be in the future, Or if I had given you one where a child of yours had decided to quit school, what would you have told them? You need to have an education if you're going to make it, don't you? Isn't that one of the things? Or, you know, if you drop out of school now, you will live to regret it. Or you can think of a number of different responses. The interesting thing about warnings, threats, and promises, what time frame do they deal with?
Future.
They all deal with the future. What does that make you?
Prophet.
It makes you a prophet, doesn't it? And you can see into their future better than they can. And what does that tell them? Again, you're their superior. Right? So we have that role of the boss, the hidden message there. We have the hidden message of the prophet. Let's go on to another response that you may have put down there. Moralizing and preaching. And one of the key words for moralizing and preaching, and we all enjoy it, is the word should or ought to. Okay? Look through what you have written down there and see if you can find any shoulds or ought tos. How about the woman who apparently was thinking about suicide? Anybody, what do you have? Do you have something? Yes.
It's too bad you think so little of yourself. That would be my first response.
Okay. All right. And she's suggesting she should think better of herself. Okay, anybody else? What do you have as a response? Any other shoulds? Yes, what do you have?
I have a should, but you feel useless and I bet it hurts.
I'm sorry,
You feel useless and I bet it hurts.
That's a pretty nice response. I kind of like that one.
Yeah.
Okay, because you're really getting in at the feeling level there. There isn't really a should there. But what happens then? How many of you have had grandparents who use axioms and maxims? I'm thinking back to my grandmother who, doggone, any time I left any food on the plate, I got reminded of all those poor kids in China and all those poor kids in India, and boy, you know. And I couldn't believe it. I have an 11-year-old son, some of you have probably seen him with me around here. And we were standing in line at a Ponderosa restaurant about 2 months ago. And it was just the two of us. As we were standing in line, he was looking up at the menu. He turned around to me and he said, "Dad, can I have a T-bone?" And before I could get it out of my mouth, yes or no, there was a gentleman, probably 20 years my senior ahead of me, who turned around and looked at him. And he said, "Why are you asking for a T-bone when there are all those kids in China that don't have any?" I couldn't believe that that was still going on. So anyway, we wind up being, if you will, the preacher. And that's the hidden message, the moral, the effect of that. That's the role that we keep taking. All right, the next one is one that, for me, is very difficult for me not to do in a listening situation. And that's the one of teaching and using logic, giving facts. If you want to add another word on there, put down persuading. Because we really try to persuade other people to a position that we want them to take. Especially if they're hurting. And we think we've got the solution, we can stop their hurting, we want to persuade them to that. How many of you tried to persuade somebody out of the position where they were there? Anyone? What did you have?
Well, that one on the early 20s. I've had pets that lost them too. I know how heartbreaking it can be. It's perhaps God's way of teaching us, preparing us for death.
Okay, all right. Excellent example of teaching in that situation. And, if you will, then also persuading them to accept that position. Okay, fine example. Anybody else? What do you have?
I Yes.
I don't have anything on here, but my father always used to say if we were upset or something had gone wrong at school, he would always say, if that's the worst thing that happens to you before you're 50, you're going to be lucky. Well, I'm not sure I want to turn 50 because I don't know what...
Maybe
I'm okay when I'm 50. But he is always trying to persuade us out of being upset, angry, frustrated.
Okay, that's a great example of that. Sure. Anybody else have any examples? Not necessarily from what was on the sheet, but any others? I find this particularly difficult here because, for me, what's my career?
Teaching.
I'm teaching, you bet. And more than anything else, I'm teaching in the area of human relations and communication. And so usually when my students come to me and they have some sort of problem, what I want to do is say, well, remember what we've been talking about in class. Let me show you how that applies. That's one of the things I have a strong temptation to do. The second one, if we could go back a bit here, is this business of using logic and giving facts or persuading. I spent many years of my life as a debate coach. And so it is just very natural for me to want to persuade other people over to my position. And so I find this probably the most difficult of the typical 12 or the roadblocks to communication that Gordon talks about here. Let's move on to that next one, that one of advising and offering solutions. Another possibility here that you can add on to that if you want to is giving suggestions to other people. Do you have any place where you have given somebody there some advice or a suggestion out of those examples? Yes?
On the last one, I suggested that maybe he should call his mother and tell her that he loves her like he told me.
Okay, all right. Good suggestion. Okay, yes, what did you have?
Basically the same thing.
All right.
All the writers, share partners in the office.
Okay. And
well, that's on where the husband said, why don't you travel with your husband? What are your interests? There are many writing classes, painting classes.
Okay, lots of good suggestions there. Okay, let me give you several different approaches to this business of giving advice and giving suggestions. When somebody comes to you and they're hurting and they say, I really need some advice and I was wondering if I could talk with you. How do you feel at that moment when they say, I'd like some advice?
Inadequate.
Okay, a lot of times we do feel inadequate. Is there another feeling that we also may have?
Flattered.
That they trust you.
All right, that they trust us, then we feel flattered, we feel good. Now, what that becomes then is the price we pay to get a listener. In other words, when I go to you and I say, I really need some advice, the first thing I have done at that moment is to admit that I can't handle the situation myself. And secondly, to let you know that I think you can, which then elevates you above me, doesn't it? I put you up, and at the same time, I've wound up putting myself down in that kind of situation. But let's take it from a different point of view. I have had situations where a student, a young lady, has come to me and she said, Dr. Watkins, my boyfriend and I have been having some real difficulties and here's what's going on. And she shared the situation. Now let's assume that I do have, out of my wealth of communication background, I have some wonderful suggestions and solutions for her, and I give them to her. Now, she comes back in the next day, and she says, Watkins, you are a wonder. You're really neat, because I did just exactly as you said, everything worked out just the way you said. And so I'm feeling really great. and I know I'm looking good in her eyes too. A period of about 3 weeks passed, and the young lady's back in my office again. And what she's saying, you know, I don't know what's going on with us, but we're having problems again, and here's the situation. I think it's a neat guy, and I want to keep him. Can you help? So she lays it out. I give her another solution. She goes back. A few days later, she's back in my office, and she says, Watkins, you are so neat. And I'm feeling so good. Now, this year goes on that way with her coming in to see me. But summer comes, and she goes to my office. And the secretary says, Watkins, oh, he's up someplace in Washington at some camp. You can't even reach him by phone. Now, that young lady doesn't know what to do. Because, you see, I've been making all of her solutions for her, haven't I? What I've managed to do in that period of time is to create a dependent personality, somebody who cannot make their own decisions for themselves. And when I'm not there, they go to somebody else rather than risk making a mistake themselves. Now let's assume, though, that I do get back this fall, and the young lady comes to my office and she says, Watkins, I missed you, but here's the situation now. It's really, really close. I'm so glad you're here, because this is our biggest one, biggest fight ever. And I suggest a number of things for her, and she then comes back 2 days later. She's got tears in her eyes, says, Watkins, I checked it through. I know I did everything exactly the way you said to do it. And he told me that he'd never been treated that way before, and he'd seen an old girlfriend over the summer, and she wouldn't treat him the same way, and he was going to go back to her and didn't want to ever see me again, and Watkins, it's your fault. Now, if you get nothing out of everything I say this week, will you please get this? The person who owns the problem is the person who owns the solution to the problem, because they are the person who must suffer the consequences of invoking that solution. They own the problem, they own the solution, and they own the consequences. Now, if the consequences turn out well, what does that do for them? That gives them a shot of self-esteem, doesn't it? They had a challenge and they overcame it, and it was tough, but by gosh, they did it. And they can feel proud of that fact, and they can go on to the next problem and deal with it. If it blows up in their face, they are the ones to say, I've learned something from it, I made a mistake, I won't make that mistake again. And they don't have to pawn that off on Watkins or somebody else. Okay, so if you get nothing out of this entire week, please get that. The one who owns the problem owns the solution, because they own the consequences of the solution. Okay. Now, before I go on, any observations, comments, questions? Anyone? Okay, let's go into the next category then. Next overall category is described by Gordon as being put down messages. There are several different kinds, actually there are a half dozen kinds of put down messages. But the hidden message, remember, as we go back to that, those two words, the hidden message. The hidden message of all put-down messages is, there's something wrong with you. Or another way of saying it is, I'm well and you're sick. Okay? So, the first put down message is that of judging, criticizing, disagreeing, and blaming. And just for your memory jog, you might think of the accuser. That's the hidden message. We wind up accusing other people. And I see it so frequently with little kids, or with our treatment of little kids. We tell them not to do something, they go ahead and do it, and so at the time that they're hurting the worst, what do we say?
I told you so.
And we just rub it right in. They've already gotten their lesson, but we give it to them in spades, okay, and just rub it right on in. Okay, now as you look through your responses there, was there anyone that you blamed or accused or said it's your own fault? What do you have?
Well, I really had trouble with the gentleman in crying about his mother forgetting to do things for her. And so my question was, why do you treat her like that? No.
Okay.
Well, that was really a compassionate response. I know that.
It was, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm being sarcastic.
All right. Are there any other such compassionate responses? Anyone? Yes, what do you have?
You mean good, didn't you?
I can feel it in the side. Okay. All right. So, that again is a very common response, you know, when somebody blunders and we just sort of rub it in a little bit further. Let's go on to another one. Name-calling, stereotyping, and ridiculing. And we have all sorts of ways of doing that. The big E, I suppose, we think in terms of name-calling for children, don't we? The children name-call. But how about adults? Do we name-call? I go through a few. I just decided I won't. But we wind up, well, we do have. Let me just mention just a few. I carry a name that I hate. I don't know, maybe some of the rest of you do too. But the name that I hate is that of being a stepfather. And I hate that because it carries with it that kind of stereotype, doesn't it? I wind up being virtually classified with other stepfathers. And I want you to know that there is nothing worse, well, there's only one thing worse than a stepfather. That's a stepmother. I wish Cinderella had had a sweet stepmother.
Mother-in-law.
Pardon? Oh, mother, oh. I stand corrected. There are two things worse than a stepfather, a mother-in-law and a stepmother. Okay, so we obviously have those. On the other hand, we do have names that we as adults call one another. And sometimes it may be something like, all right, smarty, you did it that way, all right. It may be that simple, but it still becomes a put-down, doesn't it? Okay. Third one, interpreting, analyzing, and diagnosing. And there we're talking about the analyst. And the analyst is somebody who tells us why we feel the way we feel. I think one of the neatest experiences of my life came in 77 when I had just received word from my mom, got a long distance call. We knew my dad had been ill for a while. And she said, John, the doctor says that Dad probably is not going to make it over the next couple days. And I was up in Flagstaff, Arizona at that time, and I had to get down to Phoenix to fly out to Montana. And so I drove down to Phoenix, and we lived in Phoenix for quite a period of time, and I called our pastor, Shepherd of the Hills, or Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran there. And he and I had been friends. And I called him, and when I was staying in the motel that night before the plane went out the next morning, and I said, Gene, I just talked with my mom a few hours ago, and it looks like my dad is dying. What should I be feeling, Jean? And his response was so perfect for me at that point. And his response was, John, whatever you are feeling is what you should be feeling. And how absolutely perfect that was, because I was feeling numb. I was, you know, I'd sort of made it an intellectual issue, and I've been denying the feeling part of it. And he was just right on target. But what was really neat too is that his statement really applies to us all the time, doesn't it? That what we are feeling is what we should be feeling under these given circumstances. Being who we are in these circumstances, that's what we should be feeling. And yet we will preface our comments to one another, I know I shouldn't feel this way, but. Or we will tell somebody else, you shouldn't feel that way, and then we make them feel sicker than they are already feeling. Not only are they not feeling appropriate, but we are judging them as, you know, not only are they hurting, but we're telling them that their feelings aren't appropriate. But this, with the analyst view here, we try to get in behind to tell people why they feel the way they feel. You only feel that way because you got up on the wrong side of the bed this morning. You only feel that way because in a few weeks, in another few days, you have to leave hold and you have to go back to work. That's the only reason you feel that way. And so that becomes then the analyst. And the next category, that of praising, agreeing, and giving positive evaluations. I think I'm going to let this be the last one for today. Because there is a great deal to be said about praising as a put-down. Now, usually I find that I get perplexed looks by people out there. But is praising a put-down?
Yeah. If you know that you are wrong and someone praises you for something that isn't true, it's a put-down.
Okay. There really is the bottom line, isn't it? We very frequently associate praise with flattery. And we've all been in that situation where somebody comes up and they say, gee, you look nice. You say, thank you, you do too. And then you take a second look at them. And they didn't look nice at all. And they know it, and you know it, and you know it was insincere and it was flattery. And we don't trust it. The second thing is that we frequently are uncomfortable with praise. And we are so uncomfortable with it that we tend to deflect it away from us. I had a friend several years ago. It was Christmas time. Isn't that neat? I get to talk about this on Christmas Eve day this year. I never dreamed I'd do that in July, but it was right after Christmas. And this fellow was standing on a street corner ahead of me, probably about 20 paces. And I said, Harold, I really like that coat. And he turned around. He said, it is pretty, isn't it? And I wanted to go, Harold, that's great. You accepted my praise. And then he said, my wife gave it to me for Christmas. Which meant then he could say it's a beautiful coat because it wasn't his good taste that bought it. It was his wife's good taste that bought it. You see what I'm getting at? We tend to deflect it. If I were to go back to my home in Montana where my mom is, and a neighbor lady would come over, I would probably say, Dorothy, you're looking good, or I like that coat, or something. And I can guarantee you what her response would be. This old thing, I've had it for the last 7 or 8 years. I was planning on giving it to Goodwill. I just threw it on. You know people like that? Sure. They are uncomfortable with the praise, and they deflect the praise. One last example, because I think it is so great. Who is the most famous singer of all right now?
Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson. And of all the awards that he has received, I couldn't believe it. When we happened to have the TV on, I didn't turn it on. We happened to have the TV on to, not the Grammy Awards, but it was some that were before that. And Michael Jackson goes up there for about the 13th time. And what does he say? I want to thank my mom and my dad, because if it weren't for them, I wouldn't even be here today. Totally deflecting all of this. Never has anybody gotten the kinds of awards that he has gotten, and we won't even let him enjoy it. He has to constantly be deflecting it off. We're so uncomfortable with praise. Now, tell me how nice I look.
You look average. You look fine.
You know, you don't really realize how good I do look.
Compared to what?
Because... I want you to know, I'm going to ignore that. I want you to know that you see me color coordinated. My shirt goes in my pants, or my shorts. I'm color coordinated all the way down to my socks. And red, white, you go with blue, so I've been told. Isn't that right? So, I want you to know that I'm color coordinated, and that's an important value for me. What you might also need to know, though, is that I have a friend who is a mortician, and he has an ambulance service in Phoenix. And he told me that sometimes when there's an accident, they will go out, and if the person is unconscious, and they don't know whether to take them to county hospital or to an expensive hospital, and the person can't speak for themselves, that they'll check the underwear to see the quality of the underwear. And I thought, my gosh,
that's true.
I might be walking along out here and get run over by a deer. And, well, I want you to know I look good right straight down to the underwear. God bless you. Enjoy your day.